I mean, it's a David Lynch musical. I don't know what we really expected. We just watched Industrial Symphony No. 1, The Dream of the Broken Hearted. And, well, we're ready to get snobby about this. Welcome back, everyone, to the Horror Snobcast. We are the Horror Snobs. I am Sam.
I am Spencer.
I am Sean.
And this was,
this is our first art movie.
Yeah, this was probably our first...
Art!
An autistic movie. Well, it's... I struggle at even calling it a movie. It was... First off, it's David Lynch. So right there, and then you know it's going to be artsy. But I think this was one of the most... Lynchian David Lynch things I've ever watched.
So, actually, to get obnoxious about this, there is, like, the discussion of what constitutes as a full-length movie as opposed to a short.
Mm-hmm.
This is technically considered a short.
It is considered a short.
It's only 50 minutes long.
I think 60 to 70 minutes is, like, the least amount of time to be considered a movie.
Probably.
I've heard 60 is the lowest. Yeah,
but even if it reached that, I still wouldn't call it a movie. This was... A filmed stage production.
Yep.
Is really what it was.
That's what it is. I mean, there's a movie element at the very beginning with... Nicolas Cage
and Laura Dern.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern are in this for about 5 minutes for like a little opening thing. And
they
then
have top billing, so...
Yep.
I think... So, this came out the same year as Wild at Heart. They're dressed similarly, and they're kind of doing... I think this is a sequel to Wild at Heart.
I guarantee you they filmed those scenes in between filming the actual movie for Wild at Heart.
Oh, yeah, but I think it's also... like it's kind of like, to be really snobby about this, it's the Amnesiac to Kid A.
Oh, it's wow. Look at you.
Jesus.
It's the, like, it's an extra little stuff, but it didn't fit with the rest of the movie.
Yeah, well, it's... Like, it feels like it was... The sequel to Wild at Heart done while he was thinking up the entirety of Twin Peaks.
Okay.
And he let that bleed in.
Yeah.
Because it's... Again, this is a musical, first and foremost. Julie Cruz is...
Yeah, she's the singer. She did the theme song for... She sang the theme song for Twin Peaks.
Where did you get the video from?
How'd you find it? We actually watched this off of a DVD copied from a VHS.
I'm sure you can find the remote for my VHS player.
Yeah, we've got the
really
VHS
sad.
With us.
And you children out there, that's what came before DVD.
Yes,
and before Laserdisc.
And for your super young children out there, actually, DVD is...
Laserdisc came around at the same time.
Did it really?
Yeah.
It came around at the same time? Yeah. So Laserdisc was like...
Yeah. Laserdisc is technically an analog format.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
But it's like, Laserdisc was then also in the home video market competing with VHS and DVD.
Yep.
Oh, so
for a little
VHS.
While, yeah.
Oh, yeah, DVD overtook it.
To answer the initial question, I found this VHS on Amazon.
Okay.
And there are DVDs out there. I guess there was...
So, in 2008, there was a box set released of, like, Eraserhead, Wild at Heart, Elephant Man... maybe like one or two others and a bunch of his shorts. This was one of the shorts.
I'm 90% sure I was working at Barnes & Noble when you were looking at that.
I think, yeah.
And
I had a short stint at Barnes & Noble in 2010, and it basically consisted of me going to work and Sean coming in and us talking about movies the entire time and ignoring customers.
But also we've gone to Amoeba Music down in Hollywood enough
That's
times.
True. Yeah.
And they always have it on display and I always walk over, look at it, going, I kind of want this.
And then you remember you don't like David Lynch that much.
I don't, but it's like the biggest thing that it has is like it's got Wild at Heart, Elephant Man, which are the two David Lynches I really like.
Yeah.
Also Eraserhead, but I have a Blu-ray of Eraserhead, that doesn't count. But it has the Eraserhead soundtrack, which is the other one of the bigger things. But I think it's out of print now, so it's like too expensive. So I'm not gonna.
I think that's out of print. Like the only DVD copy I could find of this was Region 2, so I'd have to get a DVD player that could play that. So I just decided, fuck it, I'll get the VHS and make a copy onto DVD. Which may or may not be legal, I'm not saying. But anyway, that's the process we had to go through to even watch this thing.
Yeah.
It's, David Lynch wrote the lyrics, and, what's the...
Angelo Badamanti?
Yeah, Angelo...
The dude who did the music for Twin Peaks.
Yeah, he wrote the music for this as well. And this was, again, right before Twin Peaks, so... Mm-hmm.
Oh, also Julia Cruz, her first two albums were lyrics by David Lynch, music by Angelo Badalamenti. So it's like okay. they had a working connection in the early 90s.
Yeah. And it's to describe this movie, I'm just going to go with what I've read the description as.
Yeah.
The IMDb description has this. It is after a breakup, a woman's dream self is the word it uses. It's her dream self, because it's supposed to be...
Yeah, actually, in the credits, the singer's credited as
dream. The dream self.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's this woman's... it's Laura Dern's nightmares after her breakup with Nicolas Cage. And that's... I mean, that's about as solid as you can get into a plot, because...
I would say that's about it.
Because to really describe the rest, I could tell you what I... would describe it as, but maybe that's not true, because it's very much you interpret it as you will.
I think that David Lynch would respect that, honestly. He would probably be cool with whatever interpretation you came up with.
Oh, no, he prefers that. He notoriously hates talking about his own movies.
Yeah.
There's a series of books of, like, director-on-director interviews. That's the last time David Lynch talked about his movies.
Yeah.
Because, like, the Criterion releases of Mulholland Drive and Eraserhead port over that stuff because they can't get him to talk about their movies now.
Is a very... The meaning of this is very interpretational. It's up to you how you want to describe it.
We have a skinned deer. We got fetuses coming down off the ceiling.
It's a choose-your-own-interpretation story.
Yeah, we got a little person reenacting the initial breakup call.
Yeah, from Twin Peaks. What's the actor's name?
Michael J. Anderson.
And he's, seductive dancer hangs out, and the most, like, Lynchian-looking clarinet player ever plays clarinet.
A relative of Angelo Badamanti.
Yeah, I was going to say that's, I saw they both had the same Badamanti last name.
Yeah.
And I figured that was probably a rarer last name than, say, Smith.
And you said that that there were two actual... performances, live performances of this.
Yeah, one was at, like, the Brooklyn Music or whatnot. Hold on. Pause while I search.
Okay.
All right, well, we'll talk. Me and Sam will keep on talking.
I mean, you can search up, but while you do that, I was surprised to hear that they actually, like, put this on live, because watching it, it's like, Yeah, it's involved. There's, like, a whole bunch of stuff going on at once on stage. And the camera editing helps kind of put that together in a way, but if you're just watching it, I'm like, I don't know what it focuses on.
Yeah, it's very, because the spotlight, I mean, like, the spotlight kind of follows her around, but there's so many other things that are going on that it would definitely be experimental theater.
Oh.
You know, like...
God, yes.
It was performed twice on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York City as part of the New Music America Festival.
Okay.
Okay.
They've got pyrotechnics, they've got, you know, some really impressive stage design.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I love the feeling of the... Because it's... industrial, I guess, you know.
It's like a broken down car on stage. You've got, like, telephone towers.
There was this one thing, like, there were, like, these, like, they look like power lines or, like, long poles that were across the
top of the stage.
The top of the stage, and it kind of made me think of, like, a music staff.
Mm-hmm.
Since it is a musical, I don't know. I like that. I thought it was cool.
Yeah. This is by far the least typical horror thing.
Yeah.
Because it's...
It's unnerving at times.
Yeah, that's... The horror element, I would say, comes there are segments where it's like very unsettling and unnerving and horrifying because of that, because of what you're watching. And even in a sense, it's horrifying because you're watching something and your brain can't immediately put together what it is.
Right.
So it's the uncertainty of it that is kind of, that makes it disturbing.
Yeah. And what's, I mean, what's funny is, okay, I'm going to start a slight rant here.
Yeah.
So,
welcome to the Rant Corner with Spencer.
All right. So I'm pretty familiar with experimental film, and Lynch always teeters on the cusp of being experimental, but not quite going over the edge.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to start this properly, but like, I'll start with the story. So, a few years ago, I think back in maybe 2007, 2008, David Lynch was doing a,
So roughly a decade ago.
David Lynch was doing a signing somewhere down in Hollywood, and he was kind of giving this talk, and so me and my friends, we were like, yeah, the free David Lynch thing.
I wonder if it was for 08, for the box set release.
Maybe. No, it was a book.
Oh, a book.
It was some book that he was doing. But anyway, he came in and he kind of took Q&A questions from everyone. And I have a friend that, like, every time we go to, like, a celebrity thing, he would always he would be that guy that would always ask a question. I think he did ask, like, a really legit question. Mm-hmm. But then there was this one kid who was in there, and you could just tell this guy fucking worshipped Lynch. He had the Eraserhead haircut. You know, he was into, because if you've ever seen David Lynch, he kind of looks like his Eraserhead character.
David Lynch has A, an amazing look, and B, one of my favorite voices of any director ever, because you hear his voice, and it's sort of like this. Maybe, not exactly.
Like that.
It's like, you wouldn't expect this to be the voice to come out of David Lynch.
But he does have the best hair of any director.
Absolutely.
He does have great hair. But so this kid, you know, he looked like he was like maybe young 20s, mid-20s, something like that, you know.
So old enough to know better.
Yeah, and so he asked a question. He said, well, what do you think about, like, Hollywood? Like, why are you into, like, aren't you, like, sick of Hollywood and all that other stuff? And David Lynch, to his credit, he, like, turned it right around on the kid, and he was like, I'm a Hollywood filmmaker. I've made all of my movies in Hollywood. I work with Hollywood actors. I am a Hollywood filmmaker, and I think that that is very true of the guy. And when you get into the more experimental places, like Stan Brakhage or
Jonas Mekas.
Yeah, exactly. Like, some of this stuff is so anti-Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, that they might be from Los Angeles or something, but, I mean, these are things that...
They're more like from New York.
Yeah. I mean, like, Brakhage was in Colorado.
Okay. Hey, for all you know, they're from Saskatchewan.
By the way, great thing about Stan Brakhage that's great is that Trey Parker and Matt Stone, when they went to his college that he taught at, this guy is, like, the most experimental filmmaker of all time. I mean, like, one of the most famous experimental filmmakers of all time. But he loved Matt and Trey, and so he appeared as a character in their, like, thesis film.
That's that fucking they made. Awesome.
He's in Cannibal the Musical. And, like, it's really crazy because you, like, people can get really pretentious in experimental film. Oh my God, right? But,
What about this? Did you think was pretentious?
The thing is like, I mean, pretentious, I guess, is subjective. The thing is...
Sometimes.
Yeah.
I do
there are times where it's obvious.
Yeah. I mean, and Lynch is pretentious, but... Yeah.
But I do like that people forget that, no, all of his movies have had budgets. Like,
yeah.
He's
exactly.
not...
Exactly.
Eraserhead is like, Eraserhead and in Inland Empire is only to... like, independent-y.
And, like, Eraserhead took him forever to make it.
5 years
or
something.
Yeah.
But Christ, even this, at the beginning, I mean, even if it was for something else, it still worked it in here.
Yeah.
It's got Laura Dern and Nicolas Cage.
So here's what I would call... I would call David Lynch the Nirvana of experimental filmmakers. He's, like, the gateway So if you're, like, into alternative or indie music, you know, like, Nirvana's usually your gateway drug to that, and then it's going to open up the rest of everything. So actually, and that's what David Lynch, I think, kind of is.
I'm going to be a little more negative about that. Okay. I feel like, I don't know, I feel like Lynch, like, I don't know, alright, this is going to be my pretentious moment.
Now Sean's rant is going to start.
It's no longer cool to call David Lynch your favorite filmmaker. Because I feel like he is he's enough in the public consciousness now that he's not, like, that offbeat, like, wild and crazy director. Because, like, there's a few people I know who just don't like movies, but they know David Lynch. They love David Lynch movies.
Yeah.
And it's, like, it kind of goes with that kid is, like, not really, but it's, like, people forget that David Lynch is a Hollywood director.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And, like, he these are the movies he comes up with, but it's just, like, I feel like He's no longer the hip, cool director to, like...
I agree with that.
Name check.
I agree with that. And I respect Lynch. I respect what he does. I think that it's fine that he brings this kind of more, quote-unquote, avant-garde into mainstream.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're into that... The thing is, like, I have been dealing with experimental film for a long fucking time at this point. And, So my rant against this movie is it's too short and it's too long, okay? Which is an experimental film problem, actually.
Well, yeah. And it's also some mainstream movies problems. Dark Knight Rises, I'm looking at you.
Yeah. A lot of mainstream movies problems.
But, like, you know, this movie should have been 20 minutes.
Yeah.
An
hour and a half.
Yeah, and actually, like, created a more... because it is narrative. I mean, this is not...
I'm sure there's a story running through it.
Yeah.
Part of the problem with, given the quality of what we had to listen to, and just, it's an issue with any live theater, especially if it's recorded, it can be difficult to understand everything that's being sung.
A lot of it's sung, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was kind of hard to hear the... I mean, I still appreciated the music.
Yeah.
And... Julie Cruz, just the tone of it, she had a very nice voice.
Yeah.
But it was hard at times to understand what she was saying.
And it's like, you feel as though, since you're not hearing the lyrics, and you know that David Lynch wrote the lyrics, that they're kind of important.
Yeah.
They're the only storyline you're getting.
Right.
But at the same time, I feel like I could, even if I had the lyrics, I still would have felt the same way. I still would have interpreted things similar to how I interpreted them.
Yeah, and go ahead.
No, it's just like Lynch doesn't really make complicated stories. He just does, like, relatively normal stories in complicated ways.
Yeah.
Right.
So it is just like, so I don't think it should have been shorter or longer. It's like, yeah, there should have either been more into it or less of it. You didn't need as many the running across the stage.
Mm-hmm. It could be... Because I guess the thing is like, we as humans from the dawn of time, I think that we're a little bit programmed to give things a story. Like, we want some kind of narrative, whether it's a book or a play or a movie or even a song, you know, a lot of the time. But that's not to say that we can't appreciate the abstract. It's just that the abstract, this is just my whole rant on it, but, like, the abstract, we can only really appreciate it for a shorter amount of time before, at least for me, before it starts to, like, lose its, and maybe I have ADHD. I do have ADHD, so it's a problem, you know? And I sometimes find, like, when people are trying to justify it, and I know that a lot of my friends are going to argue with me on this, but,
I've been willing to fight people about David Lynch for years.
he's a controversial director, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's also, like, I'm not his biggest fan, and so, like, sometimes the overpraise of him, I start to roll my eyes a bit. I love Eraserhead.
Yeah, Eraserhead's cool. I like Elephant Man, but I feel like that's barely a David Lynch movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Or it's like, that's the David Lynch has always wanted to have been.
Yeah. I don't know. And so, I remember liking Twin Peaks. I haven't rewatched it in
a really long time, I gotta be honest. I'm trying to rewatch it right now. I'm having difficulty.
Yeah.
For me, I was born the year Twin Peaks started. So, I didn't really have a way to watch it as I was growing up until later on. And so I heard all these things about it. And so I started watching it. And that kind of clouded my judgment the first time. But I could still... I had trouble still the first time. And I'm having more trouble going back. So Twin Peaks... This may be a controversial statement for fans of Twin Peaks. But I feel like that's one that... Really, people get blinded by it because of Lynch's involvement.
Right.
And he's not even that involved in it.
Yeah.
No, like, I agree. I like season one. I actually went to finish watching it when I, because I left off and I was going to pick it up. And it was like, I was on episode 10 of season two. And I was like, I thought I was on episode three. I don't remember anything that happened.
Yeah.
So then I'm going to go back, but then I just can't find the time to go back.
Baby, back to this
thing. Oh, actually, thing. Like, no, I want to continue with your avant-garde thing.
Right.
I feel like sometimes with, like, avant-garde, a lot of times people misinterpret it, too. Just, like, it doesn't have to have, like, a clear narrative within the context of, like, the thing.
Yeah.
But as long as you have a clear narrative of why you're making it.
Yeah.
If it's, like, your avant-garde attempt at, like, a breakup or something like that. But it's just, like, if it's just if it's just avant-garde to be the avant-garde for the sake of avant-garde, then it's just, like, why the fuck did you make it? Like,
yeah.
Just burn it, yeah. James Franco.
Well, for me, dealing with that stuff and, like, interpreting in my mind is there's only so much of it I can deal with at once before. Like, if I have a solid... like, specific thing I'm looking at, and it's more avant-garde. As long as it's contained there, I can look at it, and I can think about it for a long time.
Yeah.
And work on it in my head. But once you start expanding on that, and you get more and more of it, then it just becomes too much. And to a point where my mind, it's not like I can't handle it.
Yeah.
But my mind is just like, I don't want to try to deal with this. It just feels like it feels like too much for the sake of being avant-garde.
Yes.
And at that point, that's when I really think this is just pretentious, and whatever message they're going for, they've glossed over it and just
gone. With this, you know, he is making a narrative work in an interpretive avant-garde style. And so I think that, like, we get stuck into this whole, like, well, what's this symbolize? What's the fetuses coming down off the wall symbolize? You know,
yeah.
I mean, I think maybe you could go for the really obvious. She's
maybe
broke up with her boyfriend. The breakup means that maybe she dreamt of having children with this man, and now that's all falling apart. I don't know. I mean, that was my take on it.
Oh, that was my take too, actually.
Yeah, and then...
I mean, like, my take was maybe even at some point there was a baby, or maybe she's pregnant now.
Right,
and she never got the chance to tell him.
In Wild at Heart, she did have a baby, so...
Okay. But there's other parts where I'm, like... I fucking loved the skinned deer.
It was a beautiful visual.
It was really fucking creepy.
But I'm not sure what it meant.
I have no idea what it meant. You know, like... while I was engrossed by the visual, it had no bearing on this story whatsoever. So what I'm doing is I'm using an example of something that, yeah, I guess worked in a narrative sense, and then something that was beautiful and was awesome, but did not work for this breakup story, other than just maybe, like, I'm... having a breakup is painful and it feels like my skin is being taken off and I feel like I'm a skinless deer. I don't know, you know, I don't, why a deer? Why taking the skin off? You know, I don't know, you know? And, like, I mean, maybe he's trying not to go for the more obvious, maybe, like, you know, you'd have a heart or catching on fire or something like that. That would maybe be the more obvious thing. But...
because, like, when that happened, part of me was thinking, okay, there's been, like, parts of this song I didn't hear. They've got the car on stage. Was there something in their relationship, like, started the downfall? Like, did they hit a deer on the road that might have started causing problems in the relationship, and this is her interpretation of it?
Fair enough, but that's not within the narrative.
Exactly,
you know?
To make a connection to Angel... Wolf Ram Heart, another word for deer.
Okay.
Okay.
I guess. Yeah, alright.
This is the avant-garde episode, so we can't just go for Buffy. We gotta go for Angel.
Yeah.
That's Okay, that's actually a pretty good...
Fuck,
you might have broken the code.
Maybe, but, like, the fact that you had to look... you had to think that through so much. You know, because, like, I don't think that, in general, we think of a deer as a hart.
I think it's more of, like, an old-timey or maybe, like, a regional thing.
But see, it's so obscure that it becomes lost.
Yeah, you know? And it's like...
And then it just becomes random symbolism.
Yeah, well, and especially when you have much more obvious symbol, like the naked girl running across the stage every once in a while. Would I mean, for me at least, it was obvious. It was like her being vulnerable, within her dream, like uncovered, bare to the world.
Right.
So, I mean, like something about the I had to look it up, but maybe to some people, hart is a common enough term for deer. Okay. So I feel like sometimes that is the issue with avant-garde is like.
It's if regional.
I'm making references to something, it might not be the same to someone else who didn't grow up in the same. So it's like, that's also sometimes an issue with the avant-garde.
Yeah, and that was a huge problem within, like, the French, the early French avant-garde that was going on in the 20s and stuff. Actually, really fucking great movies, honestly.
Those French know what they're doing sometimes.
The German expressionism stuff was really great. It's weird because, like,
in the
1940s,
those Germans knew what they were doing sometimes.
And Lynch, I'm pretty sure that he's a fan of that early cinema. There was a question during the earliest cinema, pretty much up until the 1920s, of whether or not it was going to become what we think of as cinema, where it's almost exclusively narrative-based, at least in the mainstream.
Yeah.
But there was a question at the time, because Dadaism was happening within the art world, and which was like just this bizarre, weird, like artsy-fartsy hipster crap that was going on. I mean, they were hipsters, you know, and Salvador Dali and stuff like that. And, you know, there was, especially in Europe, less so here in America, but a little bit in America, but mostly in Europe, there was this, like, there was kind of a push towards the surreal. So
yeah, Louis Brunel did a lot of surreal, The Exterminating Angel and stuff.
Right, right. And so, you know, I feel like Lynch is kind of taking that tradition and bringing it to a more modern type standpoint. I think that Guy Madden does it better, honestly, than
I feel like it's like Guy Madden. I don't know. Like, David Lynch actually has a sense of humor. Never mind. But it's like...
David Lynch definitely has a sense of humor, but like...
Skinned deer.
Yeah, skinned deer. But yeah, I mean, Guy Madden is definitely like well aware of the...
I feel like Guy Madden's more open to showing his influences.
Yeah, and he's... I mean, like, this guy is definitely into like the old pre-Soviet Russian filmmaking stuff, but anyway, we're getting kind of off subject, but like I feel like
the subject?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is like we're in that space, but I used the word space. Yeah. Oh, sheesh.
I was gonna say there's a scene in this that I'm glad was in there, because it kind of represented some of the stuff I feel David Lynch does best, but I'm also kind of disappointed. It's I can't remember the actor's name.
Michael J. Anderson.
Yeah, he comes out with a clarinet player, and then there's a woman who comes out on stage, and they're kind of standing there, and he's reenacting.
This is the little person from
the little person from Twin Peaks.
Yeah,
he comes out and he's not reenacting. He's reciting the phone call between Laura Dern and Nicolas Cage at the beginning. This guy's playing the clarinet, and this girl is doing a very, like, intimate,
seductive.
Sexual, seductive dance. And, like, that's... I really like that scene, because that's the weird... Because David Lynch, this entire thing, it's like, he can go really weird.
Yeah.
But when he does this more subtle, subdued strangeness...
Yeah.
Like, it was, like, hypnotizing to me. There was something kind of disturbing about it, but in a way I really liked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, that stuff, I love when Lynch does that.
Yeah.
When he goes a little further with it, I can enjoy that, but sometimes, like we were saying, it can be a bit much. It can be too much abstract at once.
Yeah.
So I kind of wish that scene wasn't in here, because for a second I'm like, this is a David
this
Lynch
is what
I like
this
to
could
see.
Could have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it still could have been strange and surreal and disturbing, yeah. in a much more subtle way.
Yeah.
It's like how I, that's how I describe Eraserhead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that one's more open with its story, but it's still done in like the weird, surreal, and like interesting. I really like Eraserhead.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it in about 4 or 5 years, but I mean, and that's the thing that I'll hand to this, the same thing I'll hand to Eraserhead, is that Lynch knows how to set a tone.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and this had, you know, we'd be watching it, even though all three of us, I think, were going in and out of this story a lot, and in and out of this the film a lot, especially in the beginning, where I just was not getting connected with it at all. And it wasn't until about 15 minutes in that I started going, okay, you know, I'm going to kind of open myself up to this a little more, and because mm-hmm. it got a little bit better. There was just like kind of weird stage movement shit going on at the very beginning that yeah. didn't really like, it didn't do anything. But at least that's how I remember it. But
no, because it was like she did the song and then it was like sawing and like random stuff, and then like yeah. when she came out to start singing again, then started to like little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. But from a tone standpoint, you know, like it hit all the right marks on that. I kept on thinking of like and this was actually released by Warner Video, which was a thing back in the Warner Music Videos. They had a like it was kind of a music video division, and they
Propaganda Films.
No.
Well, I mean, this was produced by Propaganda Films.
Okay,
so was that
but it was distributed by the Warner.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but
oh no, I'm sorry.
No, and they had like distributed some other like live concerts. Like I think they did Depeche Mode's Sons of Faith and Devotion, directed by Anton Corbin, and stuff like that. But you know, it reminded me of that early '90s rock concert stuff. U2 attempted some of this similar things, with some of their tours at
Pop
that time.
Tour?
No, the Zoo TV tour.
Oh,
the
okay.
Baby one
was that,
which is actually quite good. Like it's even if you're not a U2 fan, it's actually an amazing show. But Pop Mart wasn't as good.
I like the he got stuck in a lemon.
Yeah. Got stuck in a lemon in Utah, I think.
Oh. Yeah.
That's where it happened, the Spinal Tap moment. But I like the music, you know.
Yeah.
It was cool. The girl floating around, that was fine. It looked really uncomfortable.
I just because poor Julie Cruz, because for a majority of this, she's on a harness over the stage, and
again, super Lynch. Like yeah. he always has that shit in his.
But like for anyone who's actually like worn a harness and been on them, there's only so long you can go on it before it's like not even from like this is too high up, get me down, but just from like an uncomfort and eventually mm-hmm. pain level, it's like I need to get this off.
Yeah,
because it's literally your entire body is being pulled down by gravity while this artist is saying, no, you're staying in place.
Yeah.
But your body is still like, I want to go fall to the floor because that's what gravity does. So for her to be up there that entire time, I got to give her a hand for that because I couldn't fucking
do it. I mean, I don't know how long of a shoot this took place with, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sure that it was filmed maybe conventionally. I mean, it was obviously shot on video.
But they seem to act it out the way you do a stage show where they filmed it all at once and probably took the best stuff from
right and so there was probably takes and things like that, and then there was editing decisions where there's a lot of superimpositions and stuff like that,
which again is part of the reason why I feel like it wouldn't work as seeing it as a stage show
because the stage is so diverse.
Yeah.
You know, there's
and you're always only seeing it from one angle, whereas this they were able to edit it and film from whatever angle they needed work with the way they wanted to shoot.
Yeah, it would be. I think it would be even more abstract and weird as sitting in an audience trying to figure out what the fuck's going on.
Probably.
Which I mean might be your thing.
Yeah. I don't know, because I feel like everything's too far away.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But I really like the one scene that's really sticking out to me, besides the deer scene and the fetus scene, was when she's in the trunk.
Yeah.
And they bring in a video camera, and they're filming her singing, and they have a live feed on a television set.
There was like two or three television sets that they did that on.
I really like, I don't know, I just saw that, I'm like, I like that.
That was cool, that was a cool way. But then that was another one where, like, there was a lot going on stage. Because you had that, you had each of the monitors on one side of the stage in, like, very puffy, almost wedding dresses.
Yeah.
They had two girls who looked like they were doing...
A hula dance.
Yeah, very Hawaiian hula dance.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of the stage, you had a whole chorus line of girls crammed into a corner.
Yeah.
Each kind of doing their own thing.
Yeah.
It was...
I mean, this thing... I actually think that it wasn't random at all, though. I think this thing was like... They had it very, like, blocked out. You know, this was well thought out.
Yeah, oh, it was a controlled madness.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know as much...
Which, again, is very Lynchian.
Yeah, I don't know as much about, like, theater as you do, but, like, you know, I could appreciate what was going on with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely one... Skirts the line between theater and cinema.
Yes.
You know? But yeah, I don't know.
I think it skews more towards cinema.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that. And that's the other thing, though, is that... okay, example. When they're kind of... I guess they were skinning the deer. That's kind of the way they had these people that come out and they had lights. And it looked like they were kind of skinning the deer. You know, that was cinematic, but also, like, that would have been pure experimental in a more normal cinema environment. Whereas, like, if it was a pure cinema, they would be, like, using saws or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like,
Well, I read them doing the light less as that was them skinning it, but it was already skinned. They propped it up for everyone to see, and the lights was them exposing it to the world.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
Again, this is the level of interpretation.
Yeah, yeah. And I honestly, Lynch, probably if he was listening to this podcast, he would probably be like, hey, all right, you know. He would be cool with the controversy that we're bringing up about it. He probably, like... He's probably like, yeah, I want to piss people off, and I want to challenge them, and that's cool. I mean, I respect the man. I would have a beer with him in a second, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but, yeah, anyway. But yeah. I'm definitely not the guy in the that was just devastated by the fact that Lynch is like, no, I'm a Hollywood director. I've always worked in Hollywood. I use Hollywood money. To make my movies. But, okay, and that's the other rant that I want to go on for a second.
Is that
he often has, like, A-list celebrities.
Oh, yeah.
In his films. And I feel like sometimes when you have these A-list celebrities in there, it kind of feels like they're wanting to be, like, the token artist. That, like, that's how they feel like they're trying to become a little more legit.
This is how they're breaking out of the...
Right. And the thing is, like, I think that what they're not getting is, like, it's kind of like them slumming it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times, like, experimental filmmakers and stuff like that, sometimes they're there by choice. Sometimes they're there just because that's, like, the furthest they could get in cinema, you know? Yeah. And... Maybe they would go and, like, make the next Star Wars movie if they were given the chance or something like that. But, you know...
Lynch was given the chance and he said no.
Which is kind of fucking awesome. Well, I mean, and the story behind that is great because, like, Return of the Jedi, David Lynch was offered Return of the Jedi.
I did not know that.
Yeah, along with David Cronenberg.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Both refused. But the reason why is because George Lucas wanted a Phantom direct it. Because Ivan Kershner, who directed Empire Strikes Back, that's not a George Lucas movie. That is an Ivan Kershner movie. And, like, it went way over budget, and it freaked George Lucas out. Because, really, Empire Strikes Back, at that time, was the most expensive independent film ever made.
Yeah.
And so it was like George Lucas's money was tied up in it, and we think, oh, you know, it's such a good movie now, but like, yeah, it was an experiment. It was like a, it was like a not sure thing. And so by the time Return of the Jedi came around, I think he was looking for young filmmakers he could bully. And I think that both Cronenberg and David Lynch kind of had like kind of the artistic balls to be like, no, you're probably not going to be able to bully me around. And if I do do this, it's going to be fucking weird.
Yeah. Also, wasn't this before Dune?
I believe so.
Okay. So it's like David Lynch would have done it, but I think he was even the one that was just like, George, you should do it yourself.
I can't remember.
I'm not going to do it, George.
I can't remember the name of the guy who actually did end up directing
Richard Marquand, I think.
Yeah, but he really didn't direct it. It's got George Lucas's like smell all over it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so this one,
Richard Marquand. Yeah. Marquand.
Is that his name? Weird.
I'm actually surprised I remembered that.
I fucking love Star Wars. I've gotten like a little like harsh on Return of the Jedi, like over the years.
Oh, I have my issues with Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, I like Empire.
Beginning is like, the coolest Luke's ever been, but other than that,
like when Luke comes in with the Dark Jedi, it's pretty awesome. Sorry. Wow, we managed. Well, no, I think it was a perfectly acceptable thing because it was offered Star Wars, so, you know.
Yeah, I feel like there was a few other directors in there that were also offered it, but yeah, it was like Cronenberg and Lynch are the two I remember.
Yeah.
Because those are like, of everyone you're going to offer Star Wars to, it's like, why would you do that?
But I'd offer Star Wars.
That's Cronenberg. What's happening a lot in Hollywood now, though, is like they'll get in somebody who, not necessarily, is like, it becomes like an indie darling. You know, and then they'll give him, like, the next big, like, superhero movie or something. But it's really just because the studio knows that they can boss him around. I'm thinking of a Fantastic Four is, like, the one that's coming to mind, you know.
Oh, Fantastic?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of respect what happened to that poor director because, like, yeah, he probably was bullied and...
But at the same time, I don't think it would have turned out any better had he been able to finish it.
Yeah, I think what gets lost a lot of times in that also is that he was the worst, too. So it's just like, it's a lose.
Yeah, and I mean, then you have to get into that like, how much was he trying to save face?
Exactly.
You know, to try to, like... Because, like, after that, you know, can he go back to the underground indie world?
Oh, he's got a new movie set up. He's making an Al Capone movie with Tom Hardy. He's a white male director. He's fine.
Yeah.
But Kong Skull Island. Skunk Island? No, it's Kong. Skull Island. But it's like the dude made a small... Like, you just... Like, any kind of movie that makes some kind of traction, studios are going to offer it. Because, yeah, it's like, you can get them for cheap.
Mm-hmm.
They can be pretty easily bossed around because they're usually, like, lost in the sights.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily know what they're doing, but they can work fast.
Right.
Yeah.
Is I think also the big thing is you get those studio those little independent directors who like know how to work quick.
Well, see, and that's the thing is like I think that we've entered a world where, the whole idea of the auteur director, you know, it probably started with Martin Scorsese and God damn, why am I blanking on him?
Give us a movie.
Description.
Pete's Dragon. I don't know why I'm having that one.
David Lord?
Apocalypse Now. There we go.
Oh, Francis Coppola.
He did direct Pete's Dragon. But, wow. But, like, they were, like, that start of the auteur as the director, and I think that we kind of have had that mindset, you know, which then later led to Spielberg and stuff like that.
Fucking Spielberg ruined it for everyone.
In a lot of ways, yes.
Well,
you know.
Actually.
Like, yeah.
Godfather was the first one to have kind of, like, a big, wide theatrical rollout.
Mm-hmm.
Jaws was the first one to do it right away.
No, I mean, like, conning your way onto the studio set and then, like, getting to a point where we were like, this guy doesn't work here. Fuck, we have to let him work here.
Oh, in that case, then, yeah. I thought you meant in the sense that Jaws
haven't
was the
we
first
all
like,
had, like, the haven't we all had, like, the fantasy of just getting off of the Universal, like, tour and just trying to get onto the lot? Because that's what he
did. I've mapped it out.
No, like, it's...
Fantasy.
It's a... It's... you know, I feel like as a filmmaker, like, you almost should have that map, you know, to get onto the Universal lot. But I don't know.
I was going
to
bring people with me, and every time it went by the Psycho house, I was going to have a fake camera crew outside and have people all excited, start having them talk about it. It's like, they're filming something at the Psycho house, and then they have to give me a job.
They just restored it, actually. Like, it was in really bad shape, and I guess, like, because, you know, like, that's the problem with a lot of these movie things that are in Universal. They rot away, because movie shit isn't made to last more than a couple of months.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, the Psycho house was no different. But, so they had to go through it. It was, like, full of dry rot and stuff, but they actually restored it. I'm like, yay, Universal. Yeah. You know? They let the fucking DeLorean, like, rot away until the fans had to fix it. Anyway.
Anyway, Lynch.
It's a whole other thing. But, yeah, I mean, I think I've said most of what I wanted to say about it.
So have I. I mean, again, it was only 50 minutes, so.
Yeah. We kind of knew that this one was going to be a little shorter, but, I mean, I don't even know if recommendations are if
you're a Lynch completist, I feel.
Yeah,
like.
Lynch completist. I'm going to be honest. If you can find it, I would recommend it, as long as you're someone who understands going into it. This is not just like, this isn't just like a slasher killer chasing someone around.
Yeah.
This isn't your typical horror thing. Yeah. Some people may not even consider it horror.
Yeah.
It's a very, like, again, avant-garde.
Mm.
Going into it, understanding this is going to be incredibly experimental.
Yeah.
Compared to anything else we've watched on here, and probably a lot of stuff you've watched.
Right.
And that the level of horror for this isn't just blood and guts or things jumping out. It's much more of a disturbing, like, internal kind of unsettling.
It's an atmosphere film.
Atmosphere,
you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with everything you said.
Yeah, and from that perspective, I'd say as long as you know that going in, yeah, it's worth watching to at least kind of see something maybe you're not typically going to watch.
I mean, you know, if you're going to, if you start off with David Lynch, I mean, start off with the Elephant Man and Eraserhead, you know, and work your way to this. But, you know, I think all three of us are fairly familiar with David Lynch, and all three of us are not the biggest fans, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I respect the guy,
yeah,
but I'm not a huge fan.
There are things I like, there are things I don't.
Yeah. You know, obviously to the casual, like, if I were to go to some of my friends who are maybe not as into the art world and stuff like that, and say, let's watch this movie, you know, they would be like, what the fuck am I watching? You know, and they would pretty much shut down in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah. And I mean, I would enjoy it for a very different reason.
Yeah.
Just because watching them try to comprehend this would be hysterical.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're open to maybe a new experience of what cinema can be, this would be a good gateway to it. It's very disjointed. It's really up and down.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
which again I feel is the point.
That's also just kind of a maybe you could say quote unquote a problem with all of Lynch's films, but you know, I don't think it's all very intentional.
Yeah,
you know. So anyway, so. Recommendation, I guess. Sean?
Mr. Sean?
I recommend if you're, like, going through, like, the Lynch's short films, or if you're just going through, like, a completist.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if you want an introduction to Lynch, I feel like Eraserhead's under 2 hours. It's not that long. So
right.
That, to me, would be the best one to jump in.
It's more beautiful, definitely, than this film.
Yeah.
But
yeah. I mean, yeah, there you go. All right, well, thank you once again for joining us here on the Horror Snobcast. We loved having you, as always. We hope you enjoyed having us. Spread this out to people. Now that we've talked about this, maybe even spread it out to other people who wouldn't have typically, you know, watched a horror movie. You might be more interested in weird shit.
Look at us expanding our fucking, like... And don't worry, like, we'll be back to slashers and blood and guts before you know it.
Oh,
like,
yeah, don't worry. This is...
this one was kind of a deviation, you know?
Yeah, just...
We're not going to become the horror art snob cast.
This is summing up my birthday month, and I saw this, and I was interested, so I figured, what the fuck, might as well...
The art snob cast?
Yep.
Become, I don't know.
we've got a whole bunch of horror stuff lined up. I mean, go back, tell your friends about the episodes, hop on YouTube, watch some of our old episodes there, or watch, I mean, more listen, but
yeah.
You can enjoy the very... artistically woven together slideshow I put on it that loops every few minutes just so we have something a picture for that. There's Facebook. Go ahead, follow Facebook. Follow us on YouTube also. Just follow us. Follow us, please. There'll be an Instagram up
at this
point.
If you're not following us, then, you know, we've done the best that we can at this point.
Yeah, I mean, give us some slack. I'll have the Instagram up at this point, so I'll probably put a few shots from this movie up there if people are interested, just to get like a weird visual sense before going into it.
Is it on the internet anywhere? I mean, I know that some of these really obscure titles can sometimes pop up on Vimeo and stuff like that.
It might be.
Yeah.
I can't say for sure.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I'm sure that it wouldn't be up there legally, but it's just one of those probably in that gray area.
Yeah.
Because I know that a lot of stuff is up like that. I don't know.
Everything's up on the internet somewhere.
That's true.
But yeah, thank you for joining us. We hope to have you back next week. We haven't really discussed what we're going to do next. We got some ideas. Do you guys want to do... We've been talking about doing a month of movies featuring Sam Neill for a while. We could start that.
We could do that.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, that sounds
fun.
All right,
so... can't tell you for sure what our next movie's going to be, but know that it's going to feature Sam Neill.
Sam Neill. Movie.
Yeah. So with that information, this has been the Horror Snobcast, and now you're listening to outro music, and then probably nothing.